This is the voice of the Trumpet Magazine. News, economy, politics, trends, discovery, health, family, the Bible, the future. This is Trumpet Hour, the week in review.
Hello, this is Joel Hilliker, managing editor of the Philadelphia Trumpet News Magazine. Thanks for joining us as we discuss the important events of the week with our panel here in the studio. We have Jeremiah Jacques.
Great to be with you.
And Andrew Miller.
Hello.
From our office in Britain, we have Richard Palmer.
Good afternoon.
And from our office in Jerusalem, Brent Nachtigall.
Greetings.
Midterm elections in America this past Tuesday, and they revealed a lot of what people had been realizing already, just how divided America has grown. For this story, we'll turn to Andrew.
Yeah, midterm elections unfolded as many analysts expected, with the Senate and the House going in different directions. That's actually only the third time in the past 100 years that that's happened, with back when John F. Kennedy was president in 1962, and then during Richard Nixon's presidency in 1970, had a similar thing happened where the Senate went, the president's party gained seats, well, in the House, the opposition party gained seats, which is exactly what happened this election. They're still tallying the results in the Senate. The Republicans look like they're going to have 53 or 54 Senate seats. So that's a two or three seat gain over what they had in the previous Congress. And then similar in the House, the blue wave that everyone's predicting did not happen. But they did gain 29 seats, which will or that's what they're projecting, to gain 29 seats, which will give them about an 11 seat majority in the House. So pretty narrow as far as majorities go, but still a majority for the Democratic Party.
Yeah. So when Hillary Clinton spoke just a little while back, talking about how the Democrat Party would return to civility if they took power, did this cross the threshold of what will now mean for civility in America?
No, I was definitely amongst the more radical left groups, like Antifa. They've already taken to protest and threats, I think gathering outside of a Fox News journalist, Tucker Carlson's home, or at least what they thought was his home. I guess there's still some debate over whether he was there or not, but chanting that they know where he sleeps at night. And then in the House itself, Maxine Waters, Congressional Representative Maxine Waters from California, they're looking at making her the head of the House Financial Services Committee. And so she's already talking about how they're going to be investigating the president's tax returns. And she's even the fact that they're giving her such a prestigious position is significant, in that just last summer it was her that was calling for people to do what Antifa just did to Tucker Carlson and harass and publicly confront Trump supporters and Trump cabinet officials wherever they can. And so that return to civility is definitely not something we've seen or are likely to see. If anything, this will make division in the country much worse. In the fact that obviously the Senate and the House have different powers. And so when you're looking as to what this actually means, like pragmatically or logistically for the country, in some ways it strengthens and weakens the Trump administration simultaneously. Because the Senate is the body that approves foreign treaties. The Senate is the body that approves presidential political appointments, including judicial appointments, Supreme Court appointments, Court of Appeals appointments, district courts appointments. And so this getting a 54-seat majority, where before, like during the Kavanaugh nomination, President Trump was pretty tied to making sure there wasn't a single Republican defector to get this confirmation in. Now he's going to have a much freer hand to make treaties with foreign nations, to appoint Supreme Court justices, to support other justices without having to rely on either the Democratic Party or Susan Collins from Maine. But at the other hand, the House is the body there has to approve legislation. And so if the divide with the Republican Senate, Democratic House, there's not going to be much legislation passed over the 2 years. They're just going to argue over those things.
Right.
And so you'll see the president able to be have a stronger hand in foreign policy and a stronger hand in judicial appointments, but a much weaker hand over getting laws, legislation passed, such as tax cuts, which he wanted to do, or funding for the border wall.
Right. So, well, it is interesting to consider just the way that the Democrats played their hand in the Kavanaugh hearings, even though the Senate Republicans were able to get him through. We have this. We had a a catfight, a brawl in the in America over that. You would imagine that with a strengthened Senate majority that it might be easier to pass more political appointments, more Supreme Court justices. But you would imagine that the way that the left handles that would be even more that they would be even angrier about it. They don't seem to give much heed to the fact, the legitimacy of this process based on, you know, the fact that they have the votes to be able to do that.
Yeah, and that type of protesting could get much worse, especially the fact is now with control of the House, that gives them somewhat of like a moral legitimacy to some of these protests. Where before, like in the Kavanaugh hearings, you just have protesters up in arms against this judicial appointment, against Congress. But now when you're looking at Democratic-controlled House committees looking at accusing Trump of tax fraud or accusing him of Russian collusion. A couple people have even talked about impeachment. These are things that they could do. I mean, impeachment, tax fraud, Russian collusion, which would throw fuel on the fire to people who are already protesting over these things. Now that we not only are we protesting, but the House of Representatives of the United States of America says we're right.
Yeah,
but without a Senate conviction, none of those accusations are going to mean anything at the end of the day. You can impeach, but you don't have to leave office unless the Senate backs you. You can sue for tax returns, but like I said, without Senate support, you're basically that's just like a slap on the hand. And so, if you start seeing something where the House is convicting you of wrongdoing, and the Senate's refusing to do anything about that.
The
psychological effect that's going to have on people who are already protesting over those things is going to be stark.
Right. So any thoughts on we always talk about the election being the real sign. You can take polls all day long, but when it comes to an election, you get the real truth of what the American people want. Any takeaways from the people that the American public are sending to the House, putting in governor's offices? What did we learn about Americans generally?
And generally, I mean, it unfolded, other than the Senate going conservative, which is a little unusual, it unfolded as it oftentimes does with the midterm vote being a little bit of a backlash.
Right.
Compared to the other vote. I mean, because that's when you're looking at the American electorate. I mean, it's roughly, I don't know, like 25-something% Republican, 25-something% Democrat, and then vote like 50% that just wants to watch Netflix. But, and so that's really kind of the fight is, for the most part, Republicans don't change their political opinions. Democrats don't change this political opinions. When you're in an election, you're fighting for the Netflix crowd. trying to see if you can get them mobilized to make an opinion, which oftentimes if you have a president who's trying to make positive changes to the nation and then people don't think those positive changes are coming fast enough, sometimes that mobilizes some of the people in the middle to go vote for the opposition party, which is why U.S. politics is like a swinging pendulum when you've got a Republican for one or two terms and then a Democrat for one or two terms and then a Republican for one or two terms.
Yeah. So it's essentially driven by discontent with the status quo in most cases. This is American politics, according to Andrew Miller. It's the battle for the Netflix crowd.
Yes.
Well, Andrew does have an article that digs into some of the more of the details about what to look for from this election. The title of his article going up on thetrumpet.com, Midterm Elections Reveal a Deeply Divided America. More information that you can find on that. Definitely a lot to dig into. Stephen Fleury has been talking about this some on Trumpet Daily Radio Show this past week, and I'm sure there will be a lot more to come. All of these legal battles that you're that you see in the bud in the Democratic House, a democratically controlled House, you would expect that that would eat up a lot of the political oxygen this coming year, that that's going to be something that we'll be talking about quite a lot in the months to come. We appreciate that very much, Andrew. A remarkable statement from the French president this week. He says it's time for Europe to have a unified army. For this story, we'll turn to our man in Britain, Richard Palmer.
Yes, the French president, Emmanuel Macron, says that Europe needs a real European army. He says we will not protect the Europeans unless we decide to have a true European army. And well, I think there's a couple of remarkable things about this. First of all is that he's out and out calling for a European army. Politicians, you know, they talk this way, say, in the 50s and when the EU was first getting started. Then they very quickly realized that that's not actually quite popular with European citizens. European citizens quite like their country having their own army and don't really trust a European army to protect them. And so since that time, it's all been jargon and European defense initiatives, and this is not a European army, but type explanations where they come up with some kind of sharing agreement that comes short of a full-on European army. So I think this change of rhetoric is significant. It so shows a shift that now people are coming back to a much more open push for a European military. And then I think the other thing that was really remarkable was his justification for it. He said, we have to protect ourselves with respect to China, Russia, and even the United States of America. So a very clear sign of that divide that's growing between Europe and the United States, that a French president would say, we need a European army so that we can protect ourselves from America. And it's not just France that is saying this. Friedrich Merz has very quickly emerged as the front runner to replace Angela Merkel as the leader of the Christian Democratic Union over in Germany. So she is probably, well, she's in line, he's in line to be the next chancellor at the moment. There's a huge amount of uncertainty there, but he's the most likely candidate at the moment. And just a few days before Miss Merkel announced that she was stepping down, he signed a letter along with five other German academics. And he said that Europe should work towards the goal of a common European army. All six of them said that. And he said Europeans no longer need national armies. So that's a significant, very significant statement along exactly the same lines as Macron from a man who, as likely as anyone else, will be Germany's next leader. So it's not just France that's supporting this. Around the same time, you've had a couple of academic journals talking about doing more in terms of nuclear sharing. There is one in Germany talking about how, well, Germany depends on the United States for its nuclear deterrence. They want to have some kind of European nuclear bomb. And then there is a French journal that talked about potentially having part of France's nuclear arsenal stationed in Germany or Poland as part of some kind of European nuclear sharing agreement. So you're seeing talk, at least, build towards this from the most important countries in Europe and the biggest leaders in Europe.
This is obviously something that we have been tracking closely for decades, this push for an army. As you said, to hear this kind of rhetoric coming from this caliber of leader and from these nations, in particular France and Germany, is quite extraordinary. Put this in prophetic context for us. Why the trumpet? We're much more focused on these types of statements than the average news source would be.
We are, and I think It's always important to distinguish between statements and action, and it's much easier to make these statements. It's much harder to actually accomplish this thing that they've been trying to do for decades and haven't managed. But, like you said, we've been very closely watching all of these steps that Europe has been taking to a unified military. And over the past 5 years or so, there have been some very significant steps taken towards a European military. You've got most of the Dutch army now serves in the German army. You've got large chunks of the Czech and Romanian armed forces now in the German army. People have been talking about how Germany is creating a de facto European army under its own command. Just on Wednesday this week, there was a big meeting about another new, I think this was the European Defense Initiative, but another initiative to get European countries used to working together and deploying overseas easily. So the fact that now we're having people, the whole time they've been doing all of these initiatives over the last 5 years, it's been, this is not a European army, but the fact that you're seeing this shift in rhetoric means that maybe we're getting ready for a shift in action as well, where they're starting to take these steps that they've already taken towards a European military and make it much more open, step it up a notch. We'll have to see. But we're watching this closely because the Bible talks specifically about a military power in Europe. And it's very interesting the way that it talks about this. There's a whole range of scriptures that talk about a coming European power, and they make the point that this coming European power will be made up of 10 separate nations or groups of nations. Revelation 17 talks about 10 kings that give their power unto this overall overarching empire. You know, Daniel 2 describes a power, again, made up of 10 smaller units, which, you know, now you're seeing, and all these prophecies also make clear that this is a war-making power. Revelation 17, chapter 4, for example, says that these kings shall make war. And there's a whole host of prophecies in the Bible that talk about this war-making power coming out of Europe in this end time. So a group of nations that get together and they pool their military power. Now, that's exactly what you're seeing emerge in Europe. It was because of these prophecies that right from the end of World War II, Herbert W. Armstrong said, well, they're going to set up a European Union in Europe. He even used the term. I think it was a European Union. Certainly some of these same terms that came out and Europe used over the last few decades, because that's exactly what the Bible says. And so we're seeing this conglomerate empire come together in Europe through the military, through the European Union. And now we're just watching for its military dimension to be fully unveiled.
Yes, absolutely. We will keep our eyes on that. And in the meantime, do go check out Richard's article up on thetrumpet.com this past Wednesday. French president says Europe needs a real army. We also have that trend article, Why the Trumpet Watches Europe's Push Toward a Unified Military. Again, a major prophecy that we've been tracking for decades. And we just hear more and more talk about this in recent days. So we do appreciate that very much. Richard, thank you for that. You're listening to Trumpet Hour, our week in review program on 101.3 KPCG. This week, America relaunched sanctions against Iran for its nuclear activities. We heard about this on Wednesday's program. We'll get an executive summary of it today from our man in Jerusalem, Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, Mr. Trump decided that he was going to follow through in his campaign promise, and he did reimpose all those sanctions that were in place before the nuclear deal was set up. Of course, those sanctions in large part did bring Iran to the negotiating table, even if they got what they wanted, it seems, from the nuclear deal. Nevertheless, all those sanctions that were there before Mr. Obama are back up now. And Mr. Bolton, one of the cabinet of Mr. Trump, said that there might be even more sanctions coming out soon to try and hit Iran even harder. Now, these sanctions are there, of course, to try and change Iran's behavior, something that does look increasingly difficult to do just because Iran is bent on this jihadi course that they've been on ever since the Islamic Revolution 40 years ago or 39 years ago. The anniversary was just a couple of days ago. And so to expect Iran to change fully, even with this massive financial pressure that the United States is putting on the world, that would be very surprising.
Yeah. Although it is interesting just how much, say, when America was talking about restarting these sanctions, when Donald Trump pulled out of the deal, European leaders were really up in arms about that and said that they were going to try to do everything they could to undermine America's efforts to punish Iran. And yet, now that the sanctions are coming down, it seems that they don't have nearly as much leverage as they had hoped.
Yeah, definitely not. That was one surprising thing over the last couple of days, to see the absolute inadequacy for Europe to back up its hard rhetoric on the Trump presidency. They were they said that they were going to fine European companies that pulled out of Iran because of the reimposition of United States sanctions. That hasn't happened. European companies are all mostly gone out of Iran already. Then they said that they were going to set up a financial institution somewhere in Europe so that Iranian transactions could be made with European companies outside of the scope of U.S. sanctions. And no nation in Europe has the guts to put that bank basically in their country for fear of sanctions from the U.S. And so I think that this will be this is just a side point, but I think it'd be really interesting to see what the European public thinks about this, to see all the tough talk that they had, that their governments had on Mr. Trump, Germany, France, even the UK, the other signers of the nuclear deal, and their foreign minister, Federica Mogherini, just coming down really hard on Mr. Trump, saying, we're going to figure out a way to not let this affect Iran. And yet, it's all talk. There is no power in the EU institutions right now to come up against Mr. Trump. And the public in Europe seems like they would like to do that in multiple areas, like we've talked about. And so this might be another motivating factor, or at least a wake-up call to many in Europe, that something has to change with their governments.
Yeah, that's a good point. You made right at the end, the fact that looking at this from the standpoint of Bible prophecy, here you still see America as the power with the whip hand when it comes to punishing Iran, when in Bible prophecy, it's clear that the United States is not going to be the power that really brings Iran to heel, but it will in fact be Europe. And we talked a little bit about I believe last week, some foiled terrorist attack in Denmark that represents this hardening, as you're saying, among the at least some of the Europeans against Iran in a way that seems to be out in front of their own leaders.
It definitely seems that way. There was that piece, I believe it was in Bild, that basically an editorial in Bild a couple of weeks ago as well, that said that we should support Trump with the sanctions against Iran. And then you have a number of nations outside those three that are willing to renew sanctions on Iran, but it's the big three in Europe right now, still including the UK, that aren't really doing much to counter Iran. I wrote the Trumpet brief yesterday, I believe it was, on this kind of interesting moment that we're in right now in terms of the fact that Europe seems weak, the fact that the United States seems strong, and the fact that these sanctions might actually affect Iran to the point that they might have to dial back some of their actions across the Middle East. And all three of those things are extremely temporary. This is part, we believe, of the resurgence of America, the temporary resurgence of America that God has initiated, basically for a small window of time so that people can have more time to recognize what's happening in the world, to repent of their sins, basically. But this is temporary. This is going to vanish, these three things. Europe is going to have teeth really soon. Iran is going to be put down really soon, but it's not going to be by America. America will be out of the picture, and it'll be Europe that actually has the guts then to do it.
Yeah, that's an excellent point. I would really encourage listeners to go and look at this this blog post by Brent Noctegal. Its title is This the New Normal? Iran Restrained, Europe Weak, and America Great Again? Very important to point back to that article from Gerald Flory, Saving America from the Radical Left Temporarily. You do see that, but you also see, as you bring out in that post, that when it all plays out eventually, it's going to be, as we wrote in our Trends article, Europe and Iran heading for a clash of civilizations. So it will be interesting to see how this unfolds with respect to these latest sanctions and the way that Europe goes from where it is right now to where the Bible prophesies that it will be. We appreciate that very much, Brent. This is Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3. America's sanctions are hitting more than just Iran. They're also affecting other nations, including Russia and China. It appears this could be driving these two Asian giants together. For this story, we'll go to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, I'll just start this off with a quote here. It says, "There's no sense of threat from Russia. We feel comfortable back to back." That's from Fu Ying. She's the chairwoman of the Foreign Affairs Committee of China's National People's Congress. And she said that during an interview with Bloomberg that was published on Monday. And this Bloomberg article really takes a careful and a pretty illuminating look, I think, at just how close Russia and China have become in recent years. And as you said, a lot of that is because of the increasing hostilities that both of these nations are having with the U.S. right now. But the interview with Fu Ying is really interesting because she was born back in the early 1950s. So she's lived through quite a lot of history. And in one part, she discusses memories from her childhood in China. And she talks about regularly being woken up in the middle of the night by sirens. And she and her family would have to get up and go through training drills to practice for a potential invasion by the Soviet Union. That would have been in the late 50s and throughout the 60s when China and the USSR really hated each other. And Fu Ying says that she felt like the threat from the Soviet Union was imminent and just something that was a part of daily life for almost all people in China. It was just a fear that they all lived with. And of course, that did end up erupting into some border wars in the late 60s there. But today, all of those fears are gone. And as Fu said, Russia and China feel comfortable back to back. And this Bloomberg piece just makes a compelling argument that Russia and China today are not just closer than they were during those times of hostility, obviously, but they're closer than they have been at any time in their 400 years of shared history.
So maybe some of the details that demonstrate just how close they are.
This article points out one that we don't discuss as often, which is demographics. In China, there's a huge majority of men because of the one-child policy,
right,
that was a law there for decades, led to millions of sex-selective abortions of baby girls. So right now they have millions and millions of men without a potential spouse. And in Russia, they have exactly the opposite problem. There's a large majority of women, partly because of rampant alcoholism that leads to premature death for many men. And so you have dating websites springing up in China all over the place saying, "We can connect you with a nice Slav woman." And so these kinds of things are springing up more and more, and it's becoming quite common for the two countries to marry into each other because of these complementary demographic problems that they have. But the biggest way that Russia and China are cooperating is in terms of economics. And that's because their economies, like their demographic problems, are almost perfectly complementary. China is the world's biggest manufacturer, and then Russia is among the world's largest exporters of raw materials and energy. So that really makes them just perfect natural economic partners. And then the Chinese, during this time when Russia is embattled by sanctions because of its invasions and incursions there in Ukraine, largely, China is investing and making huge energy purchases. And these are really helping Russia to resist the economic pressure that the Western nations are putting on it there. And then Russia's sales of oil and weapons to China are really helping China rise and become a formidable military power, a 21st century military power, which is what it wants to do. And that weaponry and defense know-how that Russia gives to China, that makes China much less vulnerable to a potential United States sea blockade there in the South China Sea, which is basically China's biggest fear. They are dependent on exports and imports, so were they to be blockaded there, it would represent an existential threat, really, for the country. And then Russia and China also often coordinate more and more in the United Nations. This article points out just how often they use their Security Council veto power to frustrate U.S. goals and to support each other's goals. And of course, they routinely hold joint military exercises together, which is really just laying the groundwork to potentially have a combinable military force. And this piece points out that many Western analysts used to kind of say, this is just a partnership of convenience. You know, Russia and China being close isn't really anything that we need to be worried about. But it says that today, fewer and fewer analysts say that. Today, most of them recognize just how deep this partnership goes and how much of a threat it could pose to the modern status quo.
That's quite fascinating, even for them to describe it as a marriage of convenience. When you start spelling out all of the different ways where their strengths and weaknesses complement one another and how the other is able to shore up the weakness of the other, we've been talking about Russia and China allying for decades. Herbert W. Armstrong prophesied about this based on the Bible's prophecies. We've been expecting it, but it really is quite extraordinary when you spell it out and you look at what's happening logistically that are driving these two countries into each other's arms. That's a remarkable story to see that unfolding.
It really is remarkable, and I'm glad that you mentioned Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong talking about this alliance that we now see happening, because during that time when Fu Ying was saying she and her family was having these drills practicing for a Soviet invasion and China and Russia hated each other, they were just about the biggest threat or enemy each other had for at least a few years. But even during those years of extreme hostility between Russia and China, Mr. Herbert W. Armstrong said this hostility won't last and these two will become allies. And of course, that was because of Bible prophecy. Mr. Armstrong understood prophecies in Revelation 16:12 and Daniel 11 and Revelation 9:16. And there's just several passages in the Bible that really show that in the end time, a Russia-China axis would form. And I think it's impressive that he stuck to his guns on that prophecy, even when it defied logic, and even when the facts on the ground look totally contrary to what he was saying. But now, though, I think it would be amazing if he were able to see what we're now seeing, because he had to keep maintaining that during a time when it was, you know, quite unpopular.
Yes.
But if he were alive today, he would see that what he had said would happen is, in fact, now happening.
Well, we do have a trend on our website that is called Why the Trumpet Watches Russia Allying with China, and it gives the biblical underpinning for that prophecy that Herbert Armstrong maintained, even as it was very contrary to what appeared to be the facts on the ground there. Go check that out. It's one of the most important prophecies that we have regarding Asia. It really underpins our entire view of the Asian continent. We also have our booklet, Russia and China in Prophecy, that give more details about that electrifying prophecy. We appreciate that very much, Jeremiah. You're listening to Trumpet Hour. Coming up, a poll illuminating the German people's shift to the right, a warning from Israeli security forces, and the skyrocketing cost of America's debt. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Trumpet Hour, the Week in Review.
German politics are changing because the views of the German people are changing. There's a notable shift against immigration toward stronger nationalistic views. A new poll tries to quantify some of these shifting attitudes. To learn about this, we'll go back to Richard Palmer.
Yeah, so a poll conducted by the University of Leipzig went and asked a large number of Germans, several hundred, a series of questions testing their beliefs on government, on democracy, on migrants, on Jews. And the poll showed up, I think, quite a few interesting results. So they asked questions for things like, in the national interest, under certain circumstances, is a dictatorship or the best form of government? They asked, without the extermination of the Jews, Hitler would today be still regarded as a great statesman. You know, do you agree, disagree, etc.? They had another one that even today, the influence of the Jews is too great. And for just about all of those type of questions, only about 10% agreed, which that's still a remarkably high figure for things like even today, the influence of Jews is too great. Or do you think Hitler would be regarded as a great statesman?
Yeah.
What stood out to me, though, was the number of people in the middle. There was the middle category was partly agree, partly not. And it was consistently around 20%. Which, for some of those, that's pretty remarkable. You know, Hitler would be regarded as a great statesman today were it not for the extermination of the Jews. To say, well, I partly agree, partly disagree with that statement, that's pretty disturbing that 20% of people would have that thinking. You throw in the 10% that even agree with that, and you've got 30% there saying, yeah, you know, Hitler wasn't maybe quite so bad. Then you put, when they posed some of those questions and broke it down by where they come in Germany, in East Germany, it was as high as 40% saying those kind of things. Well, maybe he wasn't quite so bad. Other questions along those lines include things like National Socialism also had its good sides. Again, 20% of people kind of agree, kind of disagree. There was another one about just asking if the Germans are superior to other races. And again, it was about 11% agreed. 20%, well, you know, partly agree, partly disagree. The other thing that really stood out is that one of the questions was, we should finally have the courage to have a strong national feeling again. And this one, nearly 40% said yes.
Yeah.
You go to East Germany and it was just under 40%. Yes, we should. And then around 30% saying, I kind of agree, I kind of disagree. So you're seeing this build up now in Germany to have we want to stop being ashamed of our history. I think this is a really big growing change within Germany. You're seeing it around the commemorations of World War One that are going on over this weekend. Mr. Flurry talked about this on the Trumpet Daily Radio show a bit yesterday, where you've got this history magazine talking about, well, World War One wasn't the fault of the Germans. And really, it was Wall Street and the bankers that imposed the Treaty of Versailles on us. And that Wall Street is to blame for the Nazis. That's what this article was saying. And then what really made me laugh is one of their upcoming issues is called German Generals, Ingenious Slaughter Winners for 2,000 Years, which goes back a bit on the peace-loving Germans not to blame for World War One point a little. But the point is, there's this big appetite building to be proud of Germany's history, whether it's not being guilty for World War One or being proud of this 2,000 year record as being ingenious slaughter masters. They want to be proud of this history and proud of the German Empire, which ties right in with this trend we've been talking about the revival of Charlemagne and some of these historical figures as well, and the way this history is being celebrated. This was a cover issue on our most recent Trumpet print edition, and I think it's one of the big trends that's emerging from Germany this year is just this belief of, you know, wanting to get back to that history and this having a strong national feeling.
You know, we are looking so closely at German politics and how they are setting the stage for a strong man to enter, and looking at the way that the Germans respond to these questions, you can see how you're going to find this individual come on the scene and be able to have a broad appeal to a whole lot of Germans. There's obviously the vast majority, or a great, at least a majority of Germans were very much against these types of things. You could see someone coming on the scene who found a way to split the difference, to harness that desire for a stronger national Germany. Even the ones who maybe are more sympathetic to the Germany of World War II and maybe more hostile to the Jews without alienating those who are maybe more against those things, opposed to those things. It talks about just this individual really having coming in by flatteries, being a very shrewd operator, having a way of talking and dealing with crowds that would harness more of a broad appeal. And you could see where that would be necessary.
Yeah, and now you see Angela Merkel fading from the scene, and that is going to be something big to watch for in German politics. It's something that you see the Alternative for Deutschland talking a lot about these themes, and they've already gotten getting close to, well, definitely 15-20% in some cases approval from the public. So you're right, you start to put a more respectable face on some of these opinions, and you can start to see how they can gain a majority.
All right. Well, thank you for that, Richard. We'll put a link up to Gerald Fleury's booklet, A Strong German Leader is Imminent. This is definitely a part of politics in Germany today we need to keep a close eye on. We appreciate that, Richard. We've been tracking the increasing activity of terrorism against Israel in recent months. And what has been happening lately? For the answer to this question, we'll go back to Jerusalem and Brent Noctegal.
Yeah, we have been looking at what's been taking place between Hamas in the Gaza Strip and Israel. Numerous rockets coming over the patrols on the riots basically on the border fence with Israel as well. But this article that came out this week, the news story that came out this week, concerns the other Palestinian territory, the West Bank. This area obviously is far larger than Gaza, has so much more population as well. And this is an area that Hamas does not control. This is controlled by the rival Palestinian group Fatah, who they are in a constant battle for supremacy over the Palestinian people. Anyway, there was the director of Shin Bet, that's the Internal Security Agency for Israel, came and gave his report to lawmakers this week summarizing what happened this past year. And it was really surprising to hear some of the numbers of foiled attacks. There were over 480 foiled terrorist attacks in the West Bank in the past year. That doesn't include 590 lone wolf attackers. They're the ones that come up and they stab somebody by themselves. That's a lone wolf attack. Apart from those, there was still 480 actual thwarting of terrorist attacks. And then another interesting part that he brought up is that there were over 200 Hamas cells in the West Bank that were broken up by Israeli security services. And so he said that while it seems that there is a calm in the West Bank and that there haven't been many terrorist attacks, this is a deceptive quiet. Those were his words. He said that Hamas is actively seeking ways to entrench itself in the West Bank right now. It's getting funding from Turkey and others, direction from Hezbollah in southern Lebanon of how to set up these sleeper cells inside the West Bank so that they can be activated in time. This is kind of alarm bells for us because we have been looking for an uprising of Hamas in the West Bank for some time. They are, of course, the more violent Palestinian group. They have connections to Iran. They take at least ideological support from Iran, as well as financial support from Iran. And in terms of being able to hurt Israel, the territory that Hamas would like to control would be West Bank. The West Bank. The West Bank rubs all the way up to Jerusalem. East Jerusalem technically is in the West Bank. You have from the West Bank, you can see the main Ben Gurion airport in Tel Aviv. You could fire at incoming international flights with missiles. And so it's really concerning when you hear the Shin Bet director basically say that Hamas is poised to activate some of its cells here to try and vie for control of the West Bank.
Yeah, two things really stand out to me. One is, of course, just how much activity there has been in terms of how hard they're working to try to infiltrate and to come down against Israel. But the other thing is you just have to marvel at how active the Israeli security has been, and all of this activity going on under the radar. They don't trumpet these things. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a couple, two, three, four attacks a day that they are foiling at 200 Hamas cells. You're talking about multiple groups of people that they're busting at the rate of, you know, several per week. And this is all happening without anybody really talking about it. It's just kind of the way that Israel conducts its business, isn't it?
Yeah, for sure it is. And they also don't want to voice successes or allow the general public in the West Bank, the Palestinian public, to understand and know how much Hamas is making a play for the West Bank, because Israelis are concerned, Fatah is concerned, that Hamas could gain control of the West Bank because it would have large Palestinian support. It's not like you have this, just like we saw in Gaza, Hamas was voted in 2006 in the parliamentary elections there. That's how they took, it's basically why they wanted to take control of that territory, because the Palestinian public wanted them to be there. I'm not saying every Palestinian wants to be ruled over by Hamas and march off to war tomorrow with Israel, but there is enough support. And so Israel is doing its best to try and snuff it out and not tell as many people about it so that the Palestinian public doesn't come on board. Mr. Netanyahu even spoke about this fact a couple of weeks ago. He basically said to Fatah, the Palestinian Authority, he said, if it wasn't for Israel in the West Bank, if the IDF wasn't in the West Bank right now policing it, Hamas would take over the West Bank in 2 minutes. That's what he said. And so that's how active they are trying to get control there. And really, we have to see this in terms of, you know, movements that are supported and directed by Iran as well. They're not Hamas doesn't work in a vacuum. They get their funding, they get their direction from the radical Islamic power of Iran. And so obviously they are pushing for Hamas to have greater control there as well.
We have an article going up on the Trumpet site called Shin Bet Director, West Bank Deceptively Quiet, that talks about this. Anything else that you would direct people to for more information, Brent?
Well, I definitely would let them read that, because it does go into the details of how we do expect, based on Bible prophecy, a Hamas takeover of the West Bank, especially as we look at the prophecies concerning Jerusalem and a Palestinian push to actually take over half of Jerusalem, East Jerusalem. That won't be led by the Palestinian Authority under Fatah. That would have to be led, that confrontation would be by Hamas. And so people can go ahead and read that article. Of course, Jerusalem and prophecy is the backing, or the gives the scriptural support for those prophecies in that article as well, Jerusalem and prophecy.
Thank you for that, Brent. The Association of Southeast Asian Nations, ASEAN, was established to give smaller Asian nations a unified voice against China. But this week, the group participated in naval drills with China. To learn more about this, we'll go back to Jeremiah Jacques.
Yes, these drills took place in Zhanjiang, China, late last month. And to me, it was really startling to see ASEAN hold this drill with China, just because one of the main reasons this group was formed, as you said, was to be able to give smaller Asian countries a unified voice and to help them kind of present a unified front to stand up to powers like China. You know, ASEAN was founded in the late 60s by the Philippines, Malaysia, Indonesia, Singapore, and Thailand. And a statement about the organization's purpose says it was formed to prevent powers from exploiting the vacuum left after rapid decolonization of the region and to give member nations a stronger voice in addressing major global powers. So these are, you know, these countries are mostly weaker countries, and they wanted to have an organization that would let them challenge bullying and other kinds of aggressive behaviors by major powers. And if you look at what China has been doing right in these countries' backyards in the last decade or so, building and militarizing islands in places that are claimed by ASEAN countries, forcing these countries in many cases to shut down oil drilling projects in their own waters, in the cases of the Philippines and Vietnam, that's happened. You know, so China has clearly been exhibiting exactly the kind of behavior that ASEAN was designed to confront. But now these countries are doing military drills with China. So it really raises questions about whether ASEAN might be realigning itself with China. And in this age when America's retreating and America's showing itself to be an unreliable guarantor of the peace, and when China is buying allies and ensnaring other countries with its debt trap diplomacy and even coercing and threatening and intimidating other countries, that kind of realignment would be rational.
Yeah, and it is exactly what we would expect, as illogical as it may be. That is what Bible prophecy tells us to watch for.
That's exactly right. In the July 2016 print edition, Trumpet editor-in-chief Gerald Fleury pretty much said that exactly this would be happening in the South China Sea more and more. I'll just read a quote from the article that he wrote at that time. It says, "Since Japan's defeat in World War II, America has protected this vital trade route and brought peace to this part of the world. Now the American military is retreating, and other great powers are coming in to fill the vacuum. China is intimidating the nations of Southeast Asia into submission to its will. It's forcing these countries to do it at once. Everything is headed in the direction of war." So it's a really powerful, you know, assessment, given that that was written 2 years ago, and now we see exactly that happening. But Mr. Fleury explains that that article and his understanding of what's happening in the South China Sea is all based on Bible prophecy. Prophecies show that America will become weaker and weaker until it just collapses, and prophecies show that Asia, especially under the leadership of Russia and China, will meanwhile form a very powerful bloc. And if you look at Ezekiel chapter 38, and other Bible passages, you see that this end-time Asian bloc is prophesied to also include many smaller Asian nations. And those ASEAN countries could well be among those that are absorbed into that bloc.
All right. Well, we'll put a link to an article that we have up on the website. China participates in first naval drill with ASEAN. And then also Gerald Fleury's article, China is steering the world toward war. It's important to understand the context of what we see happening in Asia today. We appreciate that, Jeremiah. America's debt has been rising for decades, and there are a lot of economists that say, well, it's not really a problem given the size of America's economy. The facts show it really is a serious problem. To learn about this, we'll turn to Andrew Miller.
Yeah, new figures from the Congressional Budget Office actually highlight a Bible prophecy we've highlighted on this program many times. In Deuteronomy 28 is famous as the blessings and cursings chapters. It lists the blessings that come on the nation for obeying God and the curses that come on them for disobeying God. And one of the curses listed in Deuteronomy 28, verse 43, says, "The stranger that is within you shall get up above you very high, and you shall come down very low. He will lend to you, you will not lend to him. He will be the head, you will be the tail." So if he's lending to you and you're not lending to him, basically it's an old-time way of saying you're in debt. People, you're borrowing money and you're not lending it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, these statistics from the Congressional Budget Office actually showed that our interest payments on the debt jumped 20% from 2017 to 2018.
Wow.
With they rose by $62 billion up to a full $371 billion in interest. I did the calculations. That's actually exactly 52% of our defense budget. If the interest payment, if we use the money we're paying on the debt to make another military, that military would be the second biggest military in the world, bigger than Russia, bigger than China, wow, bigger than every European nation together. And so this is just showing this, just this enormous block of money that the economists are projecting that by 2020 will have grown so big that we'll actually be paying more interest payments on the debt than we will be paying on defense, which historically, when you look at,
like, by 2020, that's really soon,
or 2022.
Oh, okay. That's really soon, too.
Still really soon, but I mean, historically, that is when nations collapse. You look at the Roman Empire, you look at the Soviet Union, when you're actually having to pay more to service your debt than you can afford to defend your nation.
Mm.
is usually a tipping point that you never come back from. And that's a tipping point that America's on track to hit in just the next couple of years.
Remarkable. We appreciate that, Andrew, you bringing that to us. I'm Joel Hilliker. That'll do it for today's Trumpet Hour. Visit the Trumpet Hour Hub on thetrumpet.com, and we'll provide links to all the articles and the booklets, the literature that we just talked about on the program today. You can email us your thoughts by sending an email to letters@thetrumpet.com. Thanks to our panel, Jeremiah Jacques, Andrew Miller, Richard Palmer, and Brent Noctegal.
Great to be here.
Have a good weekend.
Thanks for having me.
And thanks for having me.
Thanks to our staff, Dwight Falk and Josh Sloan. I'll leave you with the words of C.S. Lewis. You can't go back and change the beginning, but you can start from where you are and change the ending. Thanks for joining us on Trumpet Hour. Until next time, keep watching your world.
Been listening to Trumpet Hour on Trumpet Radio 101.3 KPCG and online at kpcg.fm. Understand your world.